The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Jeremiah Jacques for filling in yesterday from our headquarters campus there in Edmond, Oklahoma. So much going on in the news. On today's show, we're going to be talking about continuing on with the discussion about the latest terrorist attack here in the UK that happened on Monday night. And then also some interesting comments made on a talk show also on, I believe, Monday night that has to do with Jerusalem and Dr. Mazar, Alat Mazar's work there at the City of David and on the Ophel. So we'll bring that up in the next segment. Well, Britain is now on critical terror alert, the highest possible rating following that attack Monday night. This terrorist attack targeting a large throng of concert goers at Manchester Arena. A concert that was, as the New York Times said, was spilling over with Britain's children, youths. So many of them teenaged girls. This was the worst terrorist attack on Britain since the tube attacks there in July of 2005. And it comes exactly 1 month after the attack at Westminster Bridge, when another jihadist plowed through dozens of pedestrians there in the heart of London. This is what Prime Minister Theresa May said yesterday about the attack. Clip one.
It is an absolutely barbaric attack that has taken place. To cut off young lives in this way, I mean, it is absolutely devastating, and our thoughts and prayers must be with their families and friends at this horrendous tragedy that has taken place.
That was British Prime Minister Theresa May, her reaction yesterday to the Manchester attack on Monday night. British investigators fear that the 22-year-old suicide bomber may have been part of a wider terrorist network, which is what prompted Ms. May to raise the terrorist threat level from severe to critical.
In my statement earlier today, I said that the police and security services needed to investigate whether or not a BD was acting alone. Those investigations continue. But the work undertaken throughout the day has revealed that it is a possibility we cannot ignore that there is a wider group of individuals linked to this attack. This morning, I said that the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, the independent organisation responsible for setting the threat level on the basis of the intelligence available, was keeping the threat level under constant review. It has now concluded, on the basis of today's investigations, that the threat level should be increased, for the time being, from severe to critical. This means that their assessment is not only that an attack remains highly likely, but that a further attack may be imminent.
Some sobering words there from the British Prime Minister. So Scotland Yard has deployed military troops at key locations across London, like 10 Downing Street, and a number of embassies and palaces, and so on. And, of course, there's the usual admonition for everyone to go about their everyday duties and responsibilities. Keep calm and carry on, as they so often say here in the UK. But as Brad McDonald wrote again yesterday, we reposted an article from the May issue, I believe, of the Trumpet magazine, the one that he wrote following the attack at the Westminster Bridge. And we reposted it again yesterday, saying that keep calm and carry on is not working. It's not working. This isn't solving the problem. Just going about our business. It's not working. The Telegraph. I didn't get the author of this particular piece. But He's encouraging people, basically, to get up and move on. It says, and their acts cannot change anything real in our civilization. Speaking of the terrorists, it cannot change anything real in our civilization unless we make that change by our reaction. Some dozens dead and dozens more injured is a horrible outrage, but it is not an existential threat to us. It's hard to imagine writing something like this just a day or two after the tragedy. Our political leaders, it says, may need to set aside their normal affairs for an hour or two while they are briefed on events and query officials on whether policy must change, much as if they would if dozens had been killed in a train crash. So it's just like an accident, this sort of thing. And if there's an accident, if there's a crash, then we have to keep calm and carry on. But there's a political campaign or a vote coming up in a couple of weeks. And as this author suggests, I mean, we've got to get back out there and start talking about the economy and how much debt that the UK should take on and how much tax we should pay. And whether or not the UK should continue to have nuclear weapons, these kinds of things. What about rules and regulations? The costs of social care. He says, the terrorists want us to think they are important. They want to disrupt our lives, especially our political lives. But they are losers. He says here, paraphrasing what the U.S. president said yesterday. I'll get to that in a second. We should not grant them the satisfaction. Politics must go on. Well, that certainly doesn't come as much of a comfort for the families of the victims. Politics must go on. We can't let the terrorists think that they are important. And so we'll call them losers. Now, in the U.S., when President Trump said that yesterday morning, of course, everyone on the left criticized him for sounding childish, and then everyone on the right cheered him on. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They're losers. And we don't want them to be proud of the fact that we feel like that they're monsters or something like that. But I had a little bit of time, I guess, to just sort of let it sink in through the day yesterday, this comment, reading what both sides of the aisle were saying about it. And then when you think back, not even that long ago, to a leader like Winston Churchill, can you imagine Winston Churchill looking at Nazi Germany and saying, well, they're basically losers. I mean, he would call them what they were, savages, barbarians. Look at the language of the Bible, even the way that God describes these resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. It's a beast, a menacing beast. The devil's described as a roaring lion, an animal. You'll recall that when the United States struck back after the 9/11 attack, we were riding at the trumpet right off the start. That, well, how do you go after an enemy that is just called, you know, terrorism? How do you go after a tactic on the battlefield? And instead of calling it what it is, instead of labeling them who they are, that's the way that comment from President Trump struck me yesterday is, well, it's just another step in that direction of not labeling specifically the enemy that you're facing. And so it's all left in this kind of murkiness. The Bible says, look, it's a beast. It's being straddled by a drunken whore. That's what you're going up against. That's what you're facing. It's interesting if you know the context of that comment yesterday, or at least the setting. I mean, there President Trump was coming out with what was a pretty strong denunciation of what happened in Manchester. But who is he with? He was with Mahmoud Abbas, who funds terrorism. He was right there with him in the same room. Later in the day yesterday, he went from Bethlehem, the meeting there with Abbas, then he went over to Yad Vashem, the meeting there with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And this is what Prime Minister Netanyahu had to say about some of the comments that the president himself had made earlier in the day. Here's how Prime Minister Netanyahu responded to that attack in Manchester. This is clip 7.
And as you said this morning, Mr. President, funding and rewarding terrorism must end. Standing next to you, President Abbas condemned the horrific attack in Manchester. Well, I hope this heralds a real change. Because if the attacker had been Palestinian and the victims had been Israeli children, the suicide bomber's family would have received a stipend from the Palestinian Authority. That's Palestinian law. That law must be changed.
That's Palestinian law. That if a Palestinian attacker approaches a Jew from behind and stabs the Jew to death, and then he's sent off to prison, well, then the family of that attacker gets a pension from the Palestinian Authority. That's Palestinian law. And Mahmoud Abbas is the Palestinian president, and he refuses to change that law because the terrorists in that particular neighborhood are glorified. And so here is the president of the United States denouncing what happened in Manchester in the same room with this man who then gets up before all of the English-speaking press and says, oh, yeah, that was a bad attack. We shouldn't tolerate that sort of behavior. Well, the Palestinian Authority not only tolerates it, it supports it, it funds it, it encourages it, it incites it. That's the truth. And so how is this scourge, and it is a scourge, how are we going to roll it back? It's getting worse. At the Atlantic, it says here, for Europe, the attack now claimed by ISIS represents a continuation of a nightmare scenario. The pace and deadlines of terrorist attacks in the continent has reached levels unprecedented in the post-9/11 era, with the heinous and grotesque becoming frighteningly routine. He makes the point in this piece that, you know, it wasn't that long ago where they were all known by their dates. 9/11, 3/11, 7/7. But now they're happening with such great frequency. Well, you'd have to memorize 20, 30, 40 dates now. Over the past 3 years, it says, there has been an explosion in the frequency of terrorist attacks against Western countries and in the lethality of these events. From a brutal urban warfare-style assault in Paris in November 2015 to the March 2016 bombings at the Brussels airport and the Malbique metro station, to the cargo truck plowing through crowds celebrating Bastille Day on the promenade in Nice, to a truck striking a Christmas market in Berlin, and now the Ariana Grande concert. And on and on and on it goes. And those are just the big attacks. There's all kinds of horrific smaller incidents, as this article brings out. A priest whose throat was slit right in the middle of a service in Normandy. These kinds of attacks, they're becoming routine. This Atlantic piece goes back to what so many on the left, and really many on the right have since embraced it too, but what so many on the left were saying following the Arab Spring, or right in the early stages of the Arab Spring, that look at these democratic uprisings. Al-Qaeda's on the run. Al-Qaeda and radical Islamists, they're losing popularity. Here's one example of that sentiment from CNN. This is Fareed Zakaria from, I think this is March 2011. This is, again, just a couple of months into the Arab Spring. Clip 8.
There's an interesting debate about whether the events in the Middle East are good for the United States, the West, good for peace and stability. But I think there can be little dispute about whom they are bad for, Al-Qaeda. In fact, the Arab revolts of 2011 represent a total repudiation of Al-Qaeda's founding ideology. Al-Qaeda also insisted that people follow its path to create a perfect Islamic state drawing from the 7th century, and reject democracy and freedom as Western imports. Well, so far the demonstrations have been strikingly secular, largely devoted to calls against corruption and dictatorship, and affirm the importance of democracy and freedom for Arabs. Now, I've been making these points for years, but it is as if we are all much more comfortable being terrified of a phantom foe that is 7 feet tall. So just let's look one more time at the facts. Since 9/11, Al-Qaeda has been unable to launch a single attack in the United States. Small groups of people inspired by it have managed a few smaller attacks in some cities in Europe and the Middle East and Asia. But even these have been getting fewer and fewer and further between. Most terrorism is now the product of lone would-be suicide bombers rather than an organized political movement with a central figure or central organization. Political support for Al-Qaeda, Islamic terrorism, and suicide bombings has been dropping in every Muslim country in the world on which we have polling data. If the Arab world becomes more democratic, those numbers will continue to fall. In Iraq, for instance, support for political violence is tiny, lower than it is in the United States. So can we all take a deep breath, stop cowering in fear of the impending caliphate, and put the problem of Islamic terrorism in perspective? It's real, but it is not going to take over the world anytime soon.
That was the thinking early on. Not just in news media, but many political pundits. As this Atlantic article brings out, there are a lot of U.S. government analysts who subscribe to the same kind of thinking that Al-Qaeda's, I mean, their narrative is being undermined by these popular uprisings. And so there aren't going to be that many more extremists out there because they just want jobs. They just want democracy. They want the opportunity to vote. They want to get rid of these authoritarian strongmen. And so that's happened. And now we're 6-7 years in. And what is the reality? And how many of these voices, like the one you just heard there, have come out since that time and said, you know what, we got it wrong. In fact, they're still saying many of the same kinds of things. David French brings that out at National Review. I'll get to that in a second as well. They may not state it directly, like the French president did a few months back, that, well, we just have to live with it, these sorts of terrorist atrocities. But that's what so many of them are implying, that this is just going to be the status quo from here on out. Get used to it and just hope that it doesn't come to a neighborhood near you. But coming back to what that CNN reporter said there, or I guess he's not a reporter, he's more of an opinion maker on the network. This is Andrew Miller's article from thetrumpet.com just a few days ago. It says, terrorists murdered almost 30,000 people in 2015, according to the latest figures from the Institute for Economics and Peace. This means terrorists killed 6% of the 468,000 people who were murdered around the world in 2015. It says, since 2000, the year before the September 11 attacks against the United States, terror deaths per year have increased ninefold. Ninefold. Of the 29,000 people murdered by terrorists, 60% were killed by one of four Sunni Muslim groups. Now, does this sound like Al-Qaeda and those groups like them? That they're losing popularity? That they're losing their influence? It says the Islamic State killed 6,100, Boko Haram killed 5,400 and some odd, the Taliban killed 4,500, and then Al-Qaeda killed 1,620. I mean, if anything, Al-Qaeda is being superseded by some of these other groups. That when he was making those comments in 2011, nobody even heard of Boko Haram or the Islamic State. It says here, these grisly statistics, this is Andrew Miller's piece at The Trumpet, only count those killed outside the context of legitimate warfare activities. An additional 47,000 people were killed in armed conflicts with the Islamic State, Boko Haram, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. It says this number accounts for 30% of all battle-related deaths in 2015. I mean, the point is obvious. This is a scourge that's spreading. It's spreading, and now it's spreading into Europe all the more so, and in the UK, which for so many in this nation, I think it was Nigel Farage that said it Monday night. We thought that, well, we're an island and we've got good security apparatus in front of us and we've got great intelligence. And so these kinds of attacks, they might happen in Brussels, they might happen in Paris or Nice or in Berlin, but they're not going to happen in the UK. Well, they're not thinking that way anymore. This was an attack on teenage girls, and it happened right in the heart of the UK. In one of the UK's largest cities, Manchester. This Atlantic piece, it says, in fact, the Arab revolutions and their aftermath provided the jihadist movement an unparalleled boost. That's what was happening back in those critical months in 2011. And we were telling you about it with what was happening in Egypt, with what was happening in Libya. And you remember the previous administration leading the United States. I mean, it was there applauding. I mean, we came and he died. We took care of Gaddafi. We took care of Mubarak. And look at what has happened since. This attacker from Monday night, back and forth to Libya. Back and forth to Libya. Born in the UK, but his parents come from Libya. He's back and forth, and then reports that from Libya he was going in and out of Syria and receiving all kinds of training in how to kill people and how to kill little girls. But, you know, hey, we've got to have free and open borders. That's what so many are calling for. The same voices that then say, when these incidents or attacks happen, you just got to get used to it. Okay, if our politicians need a few hours to sort this out, okay. But, I mean, after a few hours, we've got to get back to politics. After all, we've got Brexit coming up. And we've got to know how much we should be paying in taxes. And what social programs we need to fund. It says here further, well, it gives the extremist movements a boost. It says the extraordinarily bloody civil war in Syria and the post-Muammar Gaddafi wreckage left behind in Libya have placed jihadists on the front lines of some of the world's major conflicts. They're on the front lines. They're not disappearing. They're not going away. They're picking up new recruits right and left. There's fighters from right here in Britain that are, as I just said, are going to Libya, are going to Syria, are joining the jihadists, and then coming back to the UK. They're coming back to Manchester. They're coming back to Birmingham. They're coming back to Liverpool and London. It says here, ISIS was able to use social media. Well, it just explains some of the tools that ISIS is making use of. They've got an Islamic State now. They've got a safe haven in Syria. They've got a safe haven in parts of Libya. They've got a base to carry out their operations. A relative safe haven. The Atlantic says those who predicted the decline of jihadism in 2011 missed several things. Most important, perhaps, is the sheer innovativeness and adaptability of major jihadist groups. And it talks about how that this is a necessity for them. I mean, they have to adapt to survive, and some of those groups are doing a pretty good job. European politicians, it says, don't have good answers to the problem of terrorism right now. Often it's regarded as the new normal, something we'll just have to live with and die with for years to come. Well, and on it goes. The conclusion here is about the worrying prospect that tomorrow will be worse than today. So you could take God's warning message and say, well, I mean, it's so negative. It's so pessimistic. It's like Jeremiah. I mean, where's the positive? There are positives in God's purpose and plan, but in the short run, look at what man is doing to himself. And there is a worrying prospect that tomorrow is going to be worse than today. In fact, it will be. We know this from Bible prophecy. Well, again, David French touches on this mentality as well. Just live with it. We've just got to live with it. He says at National Review, make no mistake, there's an emerging bipartisan consensus. It's on both sides that a certain amount of terrorism is just the price we have to pay to live the way we want to live. He goes on later and says that it's clear that we're not willing to pay the price that it takes to reduce this threat, to at least reduce it to its pre-9/11 scale. He says, consequently, an undetermined number of civilians will die horribly at concerts, restaurants, nightclubs, or simply while walking on the sidewalk. It almost certainly won't be you, of course, but it will be somebody, and they'll often be kids. They'll often be kids, teenagers, an 8-year-old. All over the papers here in the UK today, this little 8-year-old girl that died in the attack, murdered on Monday night. French says, while it's impossible to predict any given terror attack, there are two laws of terrorism that work together to guarantee that attacks will occur, and they'll occur with increasing frequency. First, when terrorists are granted safe havens to plan, train, equip, and inspire terror attacks, then they will strike, and they'll keep striking. Not just until the safe havens are destroyed, but also until the cells and affiliates they've established outside their havens are rooted out. It says here, second, when you import immigrants at any real scale from jihadist regions, then you will import the cultural, religious, and political views that incubate jihad. Jihadist ideas flow not from soil, but from people. And when you import people, you import their ideas. And so this is why. I mean, you get to, going back to the attack on London in 2005, what were the polls coming out of that? Some 20% of British Muslims saying that they could sympathize with the views of the attackers, the terrorists. That's the kind of thinking that you bring in when you just open the doors to anyone, an open door policy. Anyone and everyone. Well, it talks then about the rise in these terrorist strikes, not just in Europe. In the United States, you had the Fort Hood shooting, the Boston Marathon attack, San Bernardino, the Orlando nightclub, mass murder. It says the Heritage Foundation timeline of terror attacks and plots document a total of 95 incidents since 9/11. The numbers are revealing. After the implementation of the now much derided Bush strategy, there were a grand total of 27 terror attacks and plots, almost all of them foiled. After the end of the Bush administration, the numbers skyrocketed, with 68 plots or attacks recorded since. And then it goes on and lists all of those attacks that I just mentioned. It's not like President Bush was a smashing success, but there were a lot fewer attacks during that presidency than during the one that followed, President Obama. Further on, it says, here's the bottom line. This is David French at National Review. Since the end of the Bush and Blair administrations, it seems clear that all of the great Western democracies would rather face an increased terror risk than make sacrifices that have been proven to mitigate the danger. There's little appetite across the entire American political spectrum for an increased ground combat presence in the Middle East, So the slow-motion war against ISIS continues, and terrorist safe havens remain. In the United States, even Trump's short-term and modest so-called travel ban has been blocked in court and lacks public support. And so you have leaders coming forward now, some of them implying it, but some of them even stating it directly. Look, times are changing, and we're going to have to live with terrorism. Chancellor Merkel in Germany, she told her people recently that we're just going to have to live with the danger of terrorism. How much longer are the leaders of these nations going to be able to get away with this? Certainly, we know what's coming in Germany. David French concludes here. The Western world knows the price that it has to pay to decisively reduce the terror threat. It's no longer willing to pay the price. It's no longer willing even to let their militaries truly do the jobs they volunteered to do. So there will be more Manchesters, more Parises, more Nices, and more Orlandos. But that's what happens when we're not willing to do what it takes. See, these two, the United States and Britain in particular, the Bible says that we've lost the pride in our power. There's just no longer the appetite to fight to reduce these threats of terror. Isaiah 56 and verse 10, the prophet Isaiah there says, his watchmen, speaking of Israelite watchmen today, Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain, his watchmen are blind. They are ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. That's what God has to say about the watchmen presiding over our nations today. They won't bark. They won't tell you what's really happening. And it's either because they don't know or because they think that they've got to tell you a lie to just keep everything calm so we can carry on. Verse 11 in that chapter, Isaiah 56, the shepherds also have no understanding. They have all turned to their own way, each to his own gain, one and all. Come, they say, let us get wine, let us fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow will be like this day, great beyond measure. I mean, let's just keep filling up on wine and drink and fine dining. Selfish interests, materialism. It's like Paul said in 1 Timothy 6. These evil men who assume that gain is godliness. That some kind of material gain is godliness. And meanwhile, as the Bible says also, there's an adversary that's going about like a roaring lion, like a beast of the jungle, looking for whom he can devour. And that's the way these terrorists operate. Demon-possessed of the devil. Going about looking at whoever it is that they can just devour. Just like a lion, just like a beast in the field. And then, of course, when the crisis strikes, well, we have all of these blind dogs, as it says in Isaiah 56, coming forward and saying, just carry on. Don't get too worked up over this. We played a clip from Katie Hopkins. She had a column at the Daily Mail today. Last night she was on Tucker Carlson's show there on Fox News. And she sent out a few inflammatory tweets following the attack on Monday night. As I explained before on this program, she's sort of like Britain's Ann Coulter. She says some things that a lot of people don't like. But now there's British authorities investigating her, Katie Hopkins. They're investigating her Twitter feed. when you have terrorists in all of these sleeper cells across the UK? 2 attacks in 1 month. Here's a bit of the exchange between Katie Hopkins and Tucker Carlson last night, clip 3.
They're investigating you for your tweets in the country that gave the rest of us freedom of speech. I mean, this is very quickly kind of a philosophical question, but is a government that is demonstrably unwilling to defend its own children, and they are, despite the slogans and the tanks, this is going on a long time, is that a legitimate government? I mean, what's the point of having a government if they won't protect your children? Seriously.
Absolutely. It seems to me that the establishment are now on the side of anything that represents diversity or indeed Muslims supporting Islam. We immediately have to say the Greater Manchester head of police came out this evening and said, you know, we will not tolerate hate against the Muslim community. And it, for so many of us, we're kind of saying, well, it's OK, then we will tolerate our little girl, 8-year-old girls being slaughtered as they leave a concert, but we won't tolerate hate speech. That seems to be where we're at in the UK tonight.
That's the upside down world that Melanie Phillips wrote about in one of her books as well. Actually, I'm going to come to her column from this week, too. But Katie Hopkins said in the Daily Mail today, and she wrote in that column, that there are those that are trying to silence her. They don't want her writing in the Daily Mail. Because we need to make peace with these enemies. And we need to be united in our keep calm and carry on mindset. She says at Daily Mail, carrying on as normal is not defiance or strength. It's a default. It's the default position. When someone dies in our family, we carry on as before because the alternative is to lie down under our duvet and hope the world goes away. And sometimes we even try that for a bit too. But in the end, reluctantly, we default and carry on as normal. This does not make us strong, she says, or united. It makes us desperate to feel better. And then she says this, this country is sick. It's calling out for a doctor. We need to know what will cure us. What action do we take? What do we do? How can we stop the hurt? I look back to the missing persons and see little Safi Rousseau, smiling, aged 8, now confirmed dead. So what should we do? What action can we take? Well, I mean, her answers are having to do with immigration and borders and security and that sort of thing. But as you well know, so many of you listening to this program, there's some bigger questions to consider here. And there's a sickness. There's a sickness that goes beyond just the UK's approach to immigration or bringing in all of these refugees from various locations around the Middle East. So many of these troubled hotspots. There's a greater sickness at play here. We'll look more at that here. Coming up in the next segment, I think I'll have to break this up some since we're going a little longer than I anticipated. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So Melanie Phillips' latest column, posted I think yesterday morning at the Times of London, She's commenting on this BBC series from last week titled Three Girls. It's a three-part series on that scandal at Rochdale, which is, I think, just 10, 12 miles outside of Manchester. It's one of the suburbs there in the greater Manchester area. And if you don't know some of the history there, there was from 2008 to 2012, there were these gangs of Pakistani men that were seeking out disadvantaged teenaged white girls so that they could drug them and beat them and rape them. And this went on for years. And then finally, the British authorities, after pretty much turning a blind eye to it for some time, they finally did do something about it. And the scandal then was made known. And of course, Britain awakened to the fact that there were Rochdales all over the UK. And Melanie Phillips weighs in here saying, there are two critically important insights in the shattering and moving drama series Three Girls, broadcast on BBC last week. The first, and this is what most commentators key in on, the first is the refusal of the authorities to acknowledge what had been going on for years under their noses. The grooming, rape, and sexual trafficking of young white girls, some aged only 13, by gangs of overwhelmingly Pakistani heritage men. Okay, so that's one takeaway from this story. And this BBC series, by the way, it got the transcripts out from the court proceedings. It stayed pretty true to what actually happened. And some of it's hard to stomach. But Melanie Phillips says here, the second is the way in which Britain's indigenous society effectively served up these child victims to their attackers on a degraded cultural platter. That's the point that probably every other commentator in Britain would not address. You have to hand it to Melanie Phillips. Two critically important insights. Yes, the authorities should have done something. Yes, they shouldn't have turned a blind eye to it. Because, well, they're from Pakistan and we don't want to be seen as antagonizing a different ethnic group. She talks about the writer of this series, Nicole Taylor, and then the one that was breaking many of the stories for the Times, Andrew Norfolk. And then says later on, again, following on let me just say what it says after she mentions Andrew Norfolk, who wrote about the scandal at the Times. A scandal in which young white girls from chaotic backgrounds were pimped, raped, drugged, and beaten by gangs who passed them from man to man for multiple sexual assaults. As it says here, not only in Rochdale, but in other towns too. The police and social services ignored this systematic abuse for two reasons. First, they were afraid of being pilloried as racist if they acted against Asian men. Second, they looked upon these girls as disreputable, disruptive, and already sexually promiscuous. So when these 13, 14, and 15-year-olds said they had middle-aged boyfriends, quote-unquote, or when different Asian taxi drivers kept picking them up from school, they weren't considered worth bothering about. When they said they'd been abused, they weren't believed. So it talks about this sexual health worker who tried for 7 years to tell the police about what was going on. And then this greater Manchester detective, Maggie Oliver, who spent months and months and months trying to persuade these terrified girls to testify, to stand up for the truth. It says here, the second insight is scarcely less disturbing. So here again, Melanie Phillips said there's two critical insights to take away from this true story that happened just a few years ago. the refusal of the authorities to acknowledge what was happening and to do something about it, and then the second insight. It says, in the dock, the leader of the pimping gang exclaims, this is during the court proceedings, and he rose up and during his testimony, he said, where are your white people? They train them, the girls, in sex. They train them in drinking from a very young age. And when they come to us, by the time they're fully trained, and then they come to us. He says, look at yourself first. Look at your community. And there's certainly a lot to be said about this perverted community of mostly Pakistani men, not all of them, but certainly the ones that were engaging in this kind of behavior. But as he brought out in that court proceeding, what about the white community? Melanie Phillips says what probably no one else in Britain would say in response to that. She says his words are disgustingly self-serving, but the sting is that they cannot be denied. There's an unspeakable symbiosis between these predators and the society that fashions children into their potential victims. Children, little girls, basically roaming the streets with alcohol or drugs, getting caught up in these kinds of gangs, these kinds of networks. Melanie Phillips says, despite her heroic role as a whistleblower, Sarah Robotham, she was the social worker, and she's portrayed in the series as being a great hero that stayed with it, that kept warning the authorities after years and years and years. She's the whistleblower. Despite her heroic role, Melanie Phillips says, she hands out bags of condoms to an endless procession of girls well below the legal age of consent. This widespread policy is intended to prevent teenage pregnancy. What's been ignored, though, is the damage done to a child by treating her prematurely as a sexualized adult and making a mockery of the protective law against underage sex. See, even as she and the other social workers she was working with were crying out, saying that laws are being broken here. The police, you need to do something. And yet, what about these laws? What about the laws on the books regarding underage sex? And everyone turning a blind eye to that. Melanie Phillips says, in addition, fashion and teen magazines, pop music, and social media treat children as highly sexualized consumers. The result is that the notion of childhood innocence has been all but destroyed. See, there's more to the story. These girls don't just show up in these gang-infested restaurants in Manchester or Rochdale, looking to exchange sex for food and drink and money, unless they're very, very troubled to begin with. Total breakdown of the family unit. That's what underlies this problem. That's not just limited to Rochdale, as I said. It's all over the UK. These kinds of networks and gangs have been exposed. And I'm sure it's still going on in certain communities. And how far away is it from something that's seemingly so peaceful and serene like the area around Edstone? Manchester, I mean, we travel up there frequently for dance competitions and other things. Just an hour and a half up the road. All kinds of young girls just attending a pop concert. When you talk about the sickness in Britain, it's much more than just an immigration problem. That's what Melanie Phillips is bringing out here. Some of the same points that she makes in her book, Guardian Angel. And why aren't there more voices? Why aren't there more watchmen sounding the alarm. So many of them are just slumbering away. So many of them are just saying, hey, never mind the problem with the family. Let's go after the terrorists. Let's go after the Pakistani men in this case, in this Rochdale area. And then problem solved, and we can move on. We can keep calm and carry on with our lives, with our British culture. She says here, both at home and at school, the very notion of parenting, which depends on a clear distinction between adult and child and the overriding duty of the adult to protect the child from harm, has been destroyed. In Three Girls, this is the miniseries, the terrible distress of the father of Holly over his failure to protect his child is hard to watch. It is hard to watch. But his ability to protect her has been undermined because the meaning of childhood itself has been systematically eroded. Well, also, his role in the family has been attacked. There's a conspiracy against fatherhood. There's a conspiracy against marriage and family. And indeed, what it means to be a child, that too has systematically eroded. Melanie Phillips says, around the country, this is Britain. This is Britain today. Around the country, there have now been dozens of pimping gang prosecutions. Yet this abuse continues. Maggie Oliver says that gang members are still on the streets and committing abuses. The main reason this continues is the omission which has characterized every panicked official response to this massive scandal. An omission which also mars Three Girls. This is any acknowledgement of the role played by Islamic culture and doctrine. These pimping gangs are not ethnic. They are composed of Asian Sikhs or Hindus. They aren't composed, sorry, of Asian Sikhs or Hindus, nor of Pakistani Christians. They are a problem which the Muslim community must own and with which it must deal. Okay, so there's clearly a problem there. The responsibility, though, is wider. Here again, going back to that Pakistani man's testimony. Where are your white people? What about your community? Why don't you look at yourself first? She says, finally, the responsibility, though, is wider. Some of these abusers have been brought to account. The officials who look the other way, as young lives were all but destroyed, have not. The society that has torn up the sexual rulebook and destroyed childhood itself continues, meanwhile, on its irresponsible way. Indeed, we do. We keep calm and carry on. Just as Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, wrote about in his book from the 1960s, God Speaks Out on the New Morality. And that later became the missing dimension in sex. A total breakdown of family life. A greater threat to our society than the hydrogen bomb. This is the sickness that ought to concern us most. And there's a connection between this sickness from within and what we see happening from without. The attacks coming from without. You can go back to the Plain Truth magazine decades ago. It wasn't just what Mr. Armstrong said about Britain being on the outside of the European Union, but he talked at length about the sickness in Britain. What was once the great British Empire. God has warned Britain. He's explained his reasons for sending curses upon our nations, upon our people. In 1966, this is a warning from, 50 years ago, over 50 years, Mr. Armstrong asked, the big question is, what will it take to wake up the people of Britain? Will it take a terrible economic depression? Or will it take national military defeat at the hands of a German-dominated United States of Europe? What will it take? What will it take? It's like Mr. McDonald wrote yesterday. Keep calm and carry on isn't working. God's trying to get our attention. What more will it take for the people of this once great empire to wake up and finally say, look, what we've been doing hasn't been working. Let's look at ourselves. Let's look at our own community. Let's look at our own families. We don't see, though. The watchmen aren't helping us. And certainly we're not helping ourselves in our homes, in our families, with our children. You can see why God is sounding the alarm. God is crying out. Quite unlike all these other watchmen heading up the nations of Israel today, God is sounding the alarm. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, the bit about Jerusalem and archaeology, some interesting bits that I mentioned at the start of the program, we will have to get to later this week. And we can't get to it tomorrow because we have a special guest lined up. Nicholas Frank will be coming in from Germany, so you'll want to make sure to listen to that roundtable discussion that we have with him live tomorrow on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.